Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
In general, people are getting more and more interested in how to do things themselves. So this sort of DIY kind of movement in every area is also applying to fermentation.
Dr. Rachel Dutton studies the microbes that make fermentation happen. She's a food microbiologist, and she'll tell us about the research her lab is working on these days. More and more farmers are embracing the Affordable Care Act and signing up for health insurance. Something sweet and something savory for snacks today, Chef Daniel Orr in the kitchen. And author Maria Finn shares with us her recipe for fish head soup. All of that coming up today. We start off our headlines on the West Coast with Luann Johnson.
California's drought is only getting worse, following record low snowfalls this past winter. In response to the water crisis, Governor Jerry Brown this week announced mandatory water use reductions, a first for the state. The executive order calls for a 25% reduction on the state's 400 local water supply agencies. That will impact 90% of Californians, from farmers to homeowners to managers of golf courses. In his press conference this week, Governor Brown said the state is now in a new era. As the New York Times reports, the governor said, quote, "The idea of your nice little green lawn getting watered every day, those days are past," unquote. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics faced a sharp outcry from its members after announcing Kraft Singles would be the first product to bear the Kids Eat Right label. 75,000 registered dietitians and food professionals expressed outrage at the cheese product being the first to receive the label and threatened to leave the group. In response, the Academy and Kraft split ways, but not before packages of Kraft Singles hit the shelves bearing the logo. Kraft originally agreed to finance education and research in exchange for the label and argued the purpose was to bring awareness to calcium and vitamin D deficiencies in children. And researchers in New Zealand and Mexico have discovered that three commonly used weed killers can trigger antibiotic resistance in bacteria. Their study, published in the American Society of Microbiology journal MBio, found for the first time that low levels of glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, as well as 2,4-D and dicamba, can make bacteria quickly adapt and resist key antibiotics like ampicillin and tetracycline. A few herbicide bacteria pairings in the study caused the disease to become more susceptible to treatment, and some of the recipes had no effect at all. But in most combinations, the herbicides sparked adaptation that repelled the antibiotics much faster than they could take effect. Richard Young is the policy director for the UK-based Sustainable Food Trust.
Somehow or other, the weed killers disable the antibiotics, cause resistance to them. Now, that's not been known before, and it's really quite an alarming and surprising discovery.
The researchers tested E. coli and Salmonella, two of the most deadly and widespread bacteria in the world. Results were stark. They sent samples of the herbicides and bacteria to another researcher, who arrived at the same results without knowing what substances she was testing. Jack Heineman, professor of genetics at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand and the study's lead author, said in cases where chemicals induced resistance, the herbicides activated the bacteria's defenses to keep the toxins out. The dosage needed to do this was small, comparable to the concentration found in household use or agriculture, but higher than the concentration of incidental residue allowed on food. But he pointed out that people could be exposed to enough of the herbicide by handling a lot of food with small amounts of residue, or through children and pets who come in contact with the common weed killers on landscaped lawns. As always, read these complete articles at eartheats.org and find us on Twitter to see what other stories we're following. Join the conversation over there. We're at Earth Eats.
Great work, Luann. See you in a week.
Thanks.
Until the health insurance marketplaces opened last year, farmers and ranchers were more likely to be uninsured than many other groups. The Affordable Care Act has changed that. It requires them to buy insurance, but it also gives them coverage options that they didn't have before. For Harvest Public Media, Brian Thompson has more.
John Bailey of the Nebraska-based Center for Rural Affairs says it's hard to make sweeping generalizations about how the health care law is working for farmers and ranchers.
Depending where you live, what your individual circumstances are, how healthy you are, how old you are, it's going to make a lot of difference in what you pay for health insurance or what you have available.
But Bailey says there's little doubt that the Affordable Care Act has given farmers and ranchers and rural people in general more options for health insurance. Traditionally, there's been less competition for their business, especially in the individual market. And since farmers and ranchers tend to be either self-employed or to work for very small operations, that's the market they rely on. Bailey says farmers tend to be older, in their mid to upper 50s on average. Along with the dangerous work they do, that makes farmers more likely to have health issues and more expensive to insure. Studies done before Congress passed the ACA found that farmers were among the groups least likely to have health insurance. Don Teske is a good example. He remembers when it was virtually impossible for him to get insurance.
My hypertension, and I have a slight heart condition that was diagnosed 20, 30 years ago and is easily controlled with medication, but when that shows up on your history, then you're uninsurable.
Teske has a cow-calf operation near Wheaton in the Flint Hills northeast of Manhattan, Kansas. He's also the president of the Kansas Farmers Union. The only way he was able to get coverage before passage of the health reform law was through his wife's policy. Even then, adding him to the policy was very expensive, and he says the coverage left a lot to be desired. So Teske's wife changed jobs to get a better deal on insurance, even though it meant driving 40 miles instead of 8. The ACA, Teske says, changed all that.
But by God, for the first time in decades, I've been able to buy my own health insurance, and I'm pretty proud of that. And I'm buying it from the same company that turned me down before. And so I'm very supportive of the Affordable Care Act.
Others in farm and ranch country aren't so enthusiastic about the health care law. Kyle Baker manages a huge ranch for a landowner near Rosalia, Kansas. He also has his own smaller herd of cattle. Baker is 28 years old and in good health.
I go to the doctor maybe once a year or once every 2 or 3 years, and I just kind of want something there in case something, you know, catastrophic happens.
80% of the Kansans who buy policies through the federal marketplace qualify for subsidies. But subsidies are based on income, and Baker says it's hard to predict what his income will be because that depends on two factors beyond his control: weather and market prices.
When I kind of filled out what I thought maybe a decent year would be, I got an email that said, congratulations, you're qualified for a tax credit equal to $0 or less. And then the policies that they had on there were more expensive than the policies and not as good as the ones that I had.
So Baker opted to stay with the coverage he already had. Farm Bureau insurance agent Vernon Hurd says many farmers have done the same. Hurd's agency is in the northwest Kansas town of St. Francis, and he does a lot of business with farmers. As a general rule, he says, they don't like being told what to do, and that includes being told that they have to have health insurance. Despite that, Hurd says, he's hearing fewer complaints about the law.
Even some of the folks I've worked with that were the staunchest conservatives probably haven't voted for a Democrat in their lives recognized the fact that there were so many people that weren't able to obtain health insurance. And when you take that into consideration, I think most of my clients would tell you, overwhelmingly actually, that they think it's a good thing that we're finally able to give that opportunity to people that didn't have it in the past.
Hurd says some of his clients now have health insurance for the first time in 40 years. He calls that the true blessing of the Affordable Care Act. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Thompson.
That story came to us from Heartland Health Monitor, a reporting collaboration that covers health issues in Kansas and Missouri. Dr. Rachel Dutton is a Bauer Fellow at Harvard University, where she studies cheese and their microbes. The New York Times has called her the go-to source for chefs and food artisans seeking to unravel the mysteries of microorganisms. She stopped by the Earth Eats studios last year. Let's talk a little bit about your work with chefs. You've worked with David Chang and other chefs that are perhaps household names for some people. What questions are they asking you? What information do they want from a scientist?
Yeah, so I think chefs are getting more and more interested in fermentation, in curing their own meats, in making their own cheese, pickling. And all of those things are, I think, interesting to chefs because of the flavors that you create during these processes. And they want to be able to understand how these fermentations work so that they can control them better in their environment or maybe come up with creative alternatives to the traditional foods. So all of these fermentations involve communities of microorganisms. And so being a food microbiology lab, we are perfectly suited to trying to think about the science behind these foods and try and help them come up with new ideas. And then I think in general, people are getting more and more interested in how to do things themselves. So this sort of DIY kind of movement in every area is also applying to fermentation. So people, you know, not necessarily restaurant chefs, but people at home are making their own beer, making their own cheese, making kombucha. We actually have a kombucha vat going in our lab just for our own consumption.
Nice.
So I think just people are becoming more interested in where their food comes from. And for fermented foods, a lot of that has to do with the actual microbes that are fermenting the food. So it's a really interesting time in food, and it's an amazing time to be a food microbiologist.
Before we get too far away, what is kombucha for people who've never had it?
Yeah, so kombucha is an ancient fermented tea. So you brew black or green tea, and you add a little bit of sugar or honey, and it's this really crazy looking, it's called a SCOBY, which is a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast, and it forms this mat that floats on the surface of your jar of tea. And the yeast in this SCOBY ferment the sugar to ethanol and CO2, so gas, so it's fizzy. And then the bacteria that are part of this symbiosis convert that ethanol to acetic acid, which is vinegar. So you end up getting this fizzy, tart, tea-flavored drink, which I think for a lot of people is an acquired taste. When I first tried it, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But now I'm sort of addicted to it.
And it is not the prettiest looking drink.
No, it's not. It has these sort of like gooey kind of strands from the culture.
Yeah.
And the SCOBY itself is this incredibly interesting microbial mass. We've done some microscopy of it in the lab, and it's really interesting. And it actually produces cellulose as part of its structure. So it's just the whole world of food microbiology is completely fascinating.
Yeah. Terroir, Yes. This concept of the taste of a certain place. Terroir is a food buzzword. Talk about this idea of microbial terroir and what chefs are doing with that.
Yeah, so the idea is that because the flavor from a lot of these fermented foods, now whether that is bread or wine or cheese or, you know, your kimchi or whatever, because the flavor is coming from the microbes, if the microbes are only found in certain places, does that mean that if you make, let's say, cheese in two different places, could you potentially get different flavors based on which microbes you happen to have around? This is something that's been looked into to some extent with things like sourdough cultures and a little bit more recently in wine. We're starting to look at some of these ideas in cheese, but it's not really clear to me just yet whether it's something that we have an answer for. I don't think I'm willing to say whether absolutely yes, microbial terroir exists or not.
Stay tuned,
yes. Okay.
You mentioned sourdough. I had a bread baker mention this thing to me that blew my mind. Sourdough starters all sort of come from this one area in San Francisco. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So sourdough involves the making bread with the yeast that you would normally make it with, but it also has these bacteria called lactic acid bacteria. And they are what produce the sour flavor. And so when these bacteria were first characterized, they were characterized in the sourdoughs of San Francisco, which is known for its sourdough bread. And it's a tradition, you know, it's been a tradition for over 100 years. So when they characterized the bacteria, they identified these lactic acid bacteria that were involved in making the sourness, and they named it Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis after San Francisco.
There we go.
And so I think initially people thought, okay, well, this idea of microbial terroir, Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis, is only going to be found in San Francisco because, you know, you can only make that kind of sourdough bread. But then people started looking in Italy and other places where sourdough bread is traditionally made, and they found Lactobacillus sanfranciscensis everywhere. So it's interesting because these microbes might be very widespread in terms of what specific types they are, but they might still have unique properties based on where they come from.
Do we know how microbes travel from San Francisco to Spain, for instance?
No.
No idea?
No. No. And so that's a sort of a interesting area of study in the field of microbiology right now, is this idea of biogeography, of, you know, where microbes live and how they might travel from place to place.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Dr. Rachel Dutton of Harvard spoke at Indiana University last year. Her topic, Food for Thought, Cheese as a Model Microbial Ecosystem. My complete conversation with her is on our website, where she talks about how microbes in the cheese we eat affect the microbes we already have living in our guts. EarthEats.org. Looking ahead to the second half of our show today, how about something sweet?
Great, crumbled on top of ice cream, sprinkle it on things, on crepes, on pancakes for breakfast, so you can really enjoy this throughout the day.
Dessert before dinner with Chef Daniel Orr. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Annie Corrigan here. Hello, Earth Eats back at ya.
Okay.
He's Chef Daniel Orr.
Thought we'd do something sweet today, but you know me, a little sweet, a little spicy. So we're going to do a Caribbean-style nut brittle. So it's kind of like a peanut brittle, but we use all different kinds of nuts. We're going to take a large-bottomed pan, and we just put the sugar in there to cover the bottom, and 1 cup of corn syrup. Now, usually I don't use much corn syrup, but in this case, it really makes a peanut brittle that lasts a long time, doesn't get sticky too quick. Going to let those two melt together, and we're going to cook them until they start to caramelize and turn brown. The other thing that the corn syrup does is that it keeps the sugar from seizing up, which means it keeps it from getting real granular. So it's just one of those chemical things that does have its advantages for certain recipes. And then once all the granulated sugar is melted, then we're going to let it caramelize. So we just really want to let it sit there until it starts to turn brown. It does go from brown to black really quick, so you don't want to leave the kitchen when you're doing this. And maybe wait for that glass of wine until after you've made the brittle.
All right, a few minutes to wait for that to brown up. Good thing about his kitchen, everything is really close together, so Daniel can keep an eye on this brittle recipe as he's throwing together another dish for us. This one is with green beans.
One thing that we talk a lot about in Earth Eats is blanching and shocking, kind of a shock and awe. We've got some nice salted boiling water. You drop your green beans in there or any kind of green vegetable, and what you want to do is totally submerge your vegetable, and you're going to let that cook for about 2 to 3 minutes, okay? And then the other half of that is the shocking part. In this bin over here, we have ice water. You can see the nice ice cubes in here. We want it to be real, real cold, so it'll bring down the temperature of those green beans, hold in all their nutrients, and also keep their nice, vibrant green color. Once you've blanched and then you've shocked, you can package those green beans up and put them in the refrigerator, and they'll last for 2 or 3 days. They'll be ready for salads, just to eat in the middle of the night if you're hungry. Nice little snack there. All right, I'm just going to give these a little sample taste. Okay, perfect. And we'll move on to the next step of these nice sautéed long beans. Got a nice hot pan. You could use a wok if you're so inclined. A little bit of oil. I'm going to add garlic. Very, very hot. Ginger. I don't want my stuff to burn here. So I'm going to quickly add my long beans. Okay, stir them around. Okay, the whole thing is very quick cooking. Since the beans are already cooked, all we need to do is really reheat them. I'm going to add some other ingredients. Got some bamboo shoots, some water chestnuts, and some cherry tomatoes, and those are just going to give me some nice color. And then for seasoning, got some toasted sesame seeds. Okay, so it's really starting to look like an Asian stir fry. You could add some firm tofu to this and you'd have a main course. Just serve it with a side dish of rice or a little polenta or something like that. You smell that toasty garlic and the sesame. Okay, we're just going to put some lemon wedges around it. And you've got a great side dish, perfect for a nice low-cal, quick weekday dinner.
This recipe is at eartheats.org for you to follow along with. Speaking of polenta, Daniel made a meal of Brussels sprouts and polenta that was out of this world. You could easily swap out the bee sprouts for these green beans. Now, green beans usually pop up from the garden later in the season, but I could have sworn I saw some bags of local green beans recently. So, who knows? Keep your eyes peeled when you visit the first few weeks of your local farmers markets. You might be surprised. Each week, we speak with authors of everything from cookbooks to food history books. This week, we chatted with Maria Finn, author of the e-book The Whole Fish. She lives in Sausalito, California, which is like heaven for fish lovers such as herself.
Where I live in Northern California, we kind of have our farmers markets are just like Shangri-La.
She can buy all parts of the fish at her farmers markets, from the heads to the bones. She's learned to embrace using the more unusual parts of the animal in her dishes. Not only does it save her money, those parts are just as tasty.
You can get a fillet for $20 a pound, or you can get a collar for $5.99 a pound, and nobody knows the difference.
Here's 1 minute with Maria Finn, where she talks about making stock with fish heads, which cost her $2 a pound.
So what I'll do is I'll put, say, 2 fish heads in with maybe 6 cups of water. And say I'm making like a miso-based soup, I will cook those with some seaweed and some ginger, maybe some garlic, you know, for about an hour, possibly longer. And then I drain out everything except for the stock that's left. And then maybe add a little bit of miso, some fresh ginger, some vegetables, and soba noodles. And it's delicious. And, you know, that's the thing is everybody in the world does this except for us. All around the world, you'll see, you know, in Thailand, Malaysia, Mexico, there's fish head soups. I'm sure in Italy they do amazing things. Bouillabaisse, which, you know, you go to a restaurant and pay $28 for bouillabaisse. It's fish stock. It's from the bones and the head and shrimp shells. And, I mean, that's where bouillabaisse comes from. So you could actually probably go to your local grocery store, to the fish counter, and say, hey, you know, can I have what you're throwing out? And go home and make an amazing bouillabaisse out of it.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Read more about Maria Finn's new book, The Whole Fish, on our website. She talks about why she refuses to eat farmed salmon. Check it out at eartheats.org.
Okay.
And back to the kitchen for the final few steps of our nut brittle. Daniel Orr, bellied up to the stove again.
Okay, you can see here we're starting to get a little golden there. It looks a little bit like the Golden Girls.
Very bubbly.
Sweet, bubbly, effervescent, and a little bitter. Okay, and when we start getting that color, we're getting close. And it's important at this point to keep it stirred. It's getting more and more dark. The more you caramelize sugar, the less calories it has in it. And that's true.
Sounds like something I would tell myself to convince me that I'm eating something not quite so bad for me.
We want to fight that, so we're going to add some butter to it. Okay, you see how that's gotten quite a bit browner? Almost like a Kentucky bourbon barrel stout now. Now we're going to add our seasonings, chili flakes, ginger, salt, Chinese five spice powder. I'm going to stir this all together. Now we're going to add the nuts. I've got some macadamia nuts, almonds, and pumpkin seeds. This is, we're starting to work quick. I'm going to add the butter, 2 tablespoons. Okay, and finally, some baking soda. And the baking soda is what's going to make it real fluffy.
And that base now is almost like a brick, dark brick red.
Yeah. You want to really coat everything, turn it, make sure everything's enrobed in the sugar. You know, you get that sweet, and then you get that background with the chili pepper and ginger. Okay, now I've got a sheet tray, and then we'll just pat it out so it's an even layer. Okay, now you let this cool down to room temperature. Then you can break it up, cut it up, and store it in an airtight container, and it will last for several weeks like that. Great crumbled on top of ice cream, sprinkle it on things, on crepes, on pancakes for breakfast, so you can really enjoy this throughout the day.
Decadent, this recipe. If you want to try your hand at it, visit the website, eartheats.org. A careful listener might have noticed one ingredient these recipes had in common, ginger. Next week, I speak with someone who grows his own ginger in his house. He says it started when, just out of sheer curiosity, he planted a bulb he bought from the grocery store. Make sure you hear every episode of Earth Eats by subscribing to our free downloads on iTunes. We couldn't do it without this very dedicated team of Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for connecting with us today, folks. Fun times. I'm Annie Corrigan.